Committee on Finance and Revenue is open. Good morning, everyone. We're going to start with a couple of House bills today. We are not going to take any action on Senate Bill 663, if you're here for that. So I would like to open up a public hearing and work session on House Bill 2690. We have a couple of legislators here today to talk about that. And Kyle's here first to give us a quick briefing.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2690, the engrossed version, it's a bill relating to nonprofit corporations that develop property that's then sold or transferred to low-income individuals. So the current way, under current law, the way it's the exemption is working right now is nonprofits generally are going to receive a property tax exemption under ORS 307-130, which is the literary, benevolent, charitable organization or scientific institution exemption. However, for some nonprofits or for nonprofits that are developing property that's then sold or transferred to low-income individuals, as soon as the property is acquired by the nonprofit, in most instances, it is becoming taxable, and then it's once the nonprofit actually begins developing the property, so building a residence that will then be transferred. Once they break ground on that, generally they'll start receiving the exemption at that point. But it's kind of that time period between when the property is acquired, the land is acquired, and then development begins that the property can be taxable. And so House Bill 2690 addresses that kind of time period. And what it would does is it exempts from property taxation land acquired and held by a nonprofit corporation for the purpose of building on the land, residences to be sold to individuals with income not greater than 80% of area median income as adjusted for family size. It does require the nonprofit corporation to, within the past 10 years, have purchased land, developed it, and then transferred at least in one instance to individuals of low income. So these are for nonprofits that have already done this work in the past. The exemption is required to end at the time of title transfer, so once the property has been transferred to the low-income individual, it then becomes taxable. Absent the title transfer, the exemption is required to end after 7 consecutive years with an option for a 3-year extension, so it's a 10-year limitation on the time period that the property is exempt. And if the property after those 10 years has not been transferred to a low-income individual, it would then be required to pay the back taxes and the penalties and fees as well, so there's a bit of a clawback provision there. And this would apply to property tax years beginning on or after July 1st, 2015. We do have the paperwork on this. I can describe that after the public testimony or this time if you'd like.
Okay, thank you. Representative Wissett and Gomberg.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Excuse me. For the record, David Gomberg from House District 10 on the Central Oregon Coast. Very pleased to be here with you today with my my good friend and co-sponsor from the Sunshine District. And you've heard an excellent overview of this bill, so I will be succinct with your time and simply say that in my district on the Central Coast, affordable housing is a huge problem, and I suspect it's also a problem in your districts because it's a challenge that permeates the entire state. And there are good organizations out there that are working to address this challenge, organizations like Habitat for Humanity. The problem, and the problem that this bill is intended to address, is that when properties that are good targets for home building projects become available, it's not necessarily true that they come available on a schedule that is convenient for the organizations to also build something on that property. And so what we have is that the organization is faced with either the option of missing an opportunity to acquire a good property at a good price, or carrying that property on the books and paying property taxes on it. And in those situations, we end up in a lose-lose scenario because the organization loses the opportunity to acquire a good property at a good price. The the taxing district loses the opportunity to see that vacant property turned into a higher tax-generating property, and the community as a whole loses the opportunity to see affordable housing come available on the market. So at the request of Habitat for Humanity, we introduced this measure, which simply says, as you have heard, that that they can acquire these properties, and during the period of time, the typical period of time of about 5 years between when they acquire the property and when they're ready to build on it, that they would be held without paying property taxes. And that would give them the opportunity then to develop the property and down the road generate more tax revenue than they would have otherwise and provide affordable housing to deserving homeowners. That's the essence of the bill. You've heard that that there have been some small changes made to it and that there's an opportunity for an extension if necessary, but also a payback if they don't meet those targets. And I'll turn at this point to the Honorable Representative from the Sunshine District who can fill in a few more details.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Honorable Committee members. For the record, Gene Wisenhouse, House District 53. Now, I think the good representative from the Central Coast has done a good job. I think I just make some comments that this session we've talked about affordable housing, and this is affordable housing issue. Best thing can do put a family in a home where they have responsibility for looking after that, managing their money, and Habitat does a great has a great program and a high success rate. We were approached, as Representative Gomberg said, during the summer by Habitat to look into this and see if we could support it and if we thought we could pass the bill. We worked together. The good representative of Central Coast did a lot of the work as far as putting the sideboards on it in the House, and I think it's a great bill and urge your support. Thank you.
Questions? Gentlemen, thank you.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Move the bill to the floor, and don't forget sand control districts that are up later on your agenda, too. Thank you.
This is easier than sand
That's
control.
That's not
No, wait a second.
Yes, it is.
You were doing so well.
Yeah. That's right. Can we ask you to pick one of the two, Mr. Chair?
Shannon Vilhauer and Tom Linhires.
Good morning, Chair Haas and members of the committee. I'm Shannon Vilhauer, Executive Director with Habitat for Humanity of Oregon. Thank you so much for considering House Bill 2690A. This legislation is so important to Habitat for Humanity affiliates statewide. during the past 3 years, we've provided affordable home ownership opportunities for 256 families in Oregon. We've got 30 affiliates around our state. 22 are located in very rural communities. In some of those communities, Habitat is actually the only affordable housing developer. This program is very successful. The children living in Habitat homes, low-income kids who become homeowners and benefit from that stability, are 16% more likely to graduate from high school and more than 64% more likely to receive post-secondary education. I know that education is a big emphasis this session, and there's a direct tie with stable and affordable and healthy homes. We just have had more qualifying families come to us than ever, so we're looking at creative solutions that will enable us to house more families more quickly. This legislation, if it's passed, will free up about $200,000 a year, which is roughly enough for us to build three more homes each year, which is really what we want to do. So thank you so much for your consideration and your service.
Thank you, Tom.
Chair Haas, members of the committee, my name is Tom Linhares, and I represent the Oregon State Association of County Assessors. While we typically don't take positions on exemption bills, what property should be taxable, what property should be exempt, we feel that's a discussion and decision best left to legislators, not the administrators of the tax system. But this bill emphasizes the difficulty of applying exemption policy under 307.130, which is an overly broad that's not even ill-defined. There's no definitions at all of what constitutes charity. The bill says property used exclusively for charitable purposes can be exempt, but it doesn't define charity. And the courts have ruled that very little charitable work needs to apply. So to give you an example, early in the session we were talking about House Bill 2690 in our legislative committee meeting, and some assessors said, well, we don't exempt Habitat for Humanity properties until the building is actually under construction. Other assessors said, we'll start the exemption once the building permit is issued. Some assessors said, We don't exempt it at all, whether the house is being built or not, because it's not being used for charitable purposes. So that kind of gives you a good example of how 307.130, as poorly written as it is, does not allow for a fair, accurate, and consistent application of your policy statewide. What we like about 2690 is it takes this exemption out of 307.130, puts it in its own statute, clearly defined. Your policy is easy to understand, and it's easy to administer such that it can be applied fairly, accurately, and consistently across all 36 counties. And that's what we like about the bill. So we urge your support.
Thank you. Senator Bopas?
I'm ready to move. Your
bill looks like it's in trouble to me. Okay. Thank you both.
You've been doing this a long time, haven't you, Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
That insight is very keen.
Well, Senator Boquist.
We're in a work session, Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir.
I move House Bill 2698 to the floor.
Let me make sure we're in work session. I'll open up a work session on House Bill 2690.
Just complimented him about his flow and everything. We're not even sure. Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2698 to the floor with a due pass recommendation, as long as it doesn't apply to Sand District.
Senator Boquist moves House Bill 2690 to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none. Any objections? Seeing none. We are to Senator Boquist.
Lovely, Mr. Chair.
Lovely.
Duties. I love voluntold.
Very good. I'll close the work session and open up a public hearing and work session on House Bill 3492. Kyle?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3492A. We do have a dash A4 amendment, which I'll get to in just a second. But first, just to describe the bill as engrossed, it would require the engrossed version would require a county or a county in a city, if property is located within city boundaries, upon request of an owner of a solar project, to enter into an agreement for a period not to exceed 20 years. Pursuant to which the property constituting a solar project is exempt from property taxation, and then the owner of the solar property would pay an in-lieu fee. Now, the in-lieu fee is established equal to $7,000 per megawatt of nameplate capacity of the solar project. It requires the fee revenue to be distributed proportionally to taxing districts within which the solar project is located, based upon each district's ad valorem property taxes, excluding those for bonded indebtedness. So it would be based upon the operating taxes of the taxing districts in which the solar project is in. So rather, since it's not paying property taxes, the fee revenue will be distributed as if the in more or less the same way as the property taxes would have been, with the exclusion of bonds, which, of course, bonds are a levy-based, so they work a little bit differently there. It requires the county assessor to calculate and levy the fee based upon information required to be provided by the solar project owner. It does establish a fee deadline and late payment criteria, and requires the solar project failing to pay the fee for more than 1 year during the term of the agreement to be disqualified from the exemption and pay a penalty equal to 1 year of the fee. And the penalty is credited to the general fund of the county in which the property is located. It does prohibit the solar project that has received an exemption from for any property tax year under the Rural Renewable Energy Development Zone or the Strategic Investment Zone from receiving the exemption and the in-lieu payment. So if the solar project has already received an exemption of those two exemption programs, then it cannot receive this exemption and pay the in-lieu fee. It repeals the exemption and in-lieu fee for the property first qualifying for exemption on or after January 2nd, 2022. But for those that are already in process or have qualified, they'll continue to do so afterwards. It's just for the new properties coming in, is that sunset date. And it will apply to property tax years beginning on or after July 1st, 2016. The dash A4 amendment makes changes. Rather than requiring a county or a county in a city to provide the exemption in lieu fee, it allows a county and the owner to decide whether or not to allow it. So it would be up to the counties and the cities to decide whether to allow the exemption and the in lieu fee rather than be required to do it. The other change in the A4 is the in lieu penalty. So if for some reason the solar property fails to pay the in-lieu fee and they become disqualified, rather than the penalty being distributed to the general fund of the county in which it resides, it would be the penalty would be distributed to all the taxing districts based upon the proportional share. So those are the two changes in the A4. And if you'd like, I can step through the revenue impact at this time.
Well, I just see in the revenue impact that because it would allow and not require, it makes it difficult to have a hard and fast figure.
Yeah, so that's with the A4, because it would now be discretionary for the counties and the cities if the property is located within a city, mm-hmm. There would be no direct revenue impact. Now, the revenue impact for the A engrossed version, it actually shows a revenue increase, which the reason for that is right now solar properties can generally, depending on where they're developed, if they're developed within a rural renewable energy development zone, they receive a property tax exemption for the first 5 years. So the way that the revenue impact was constructed is, well, absent this change in House Bill 3492A, they would use the rural renewable development zone exemption, receive an exemption for 5 years, but then they come on the roll. So by doing this, the overall 20 years or so the project exists, you would pay reduced taxes, but initially it would look as a revenue increase because the 3 to 5 year exemption is worth more in the short term than the 3492 change is. However, in the long term, it would be more beneficial in most cases for a solar project to use House Bill 3492's changes. So it shows an initial revenue increase. Over a 20-year span, you'd see a revenue decrease. It depends upon the solar project, a number of factors, what that decrease would be. It could range between the tax pay being between, say, 30% of what would be paid over 20 years, or up to maybe 50, 60, or even 70% reduction in tax. But it depends on a number of factors, the type of benefit that the solar project would receive.
Okay. Question to staff, Mr. Chair.
Senator Boquist.
Kyle, could you just confirm, you may not know, but the witness is coming up can answer if you don't know. My understanding is the A4 is some technical fixes which were raised by the no votes, kind of the odd couples, matter of fact, in the House side, that there were these minor changes in the A4s or trying to alleviate some concerns raised by House members. Is that correct?
Senator Boquist, I couldn't speak to whether or not that was, if it addresses the concerns of the no votes. But yeah, one change is pretty technical in that the disbursement of the penalty fee is pretty small, and then the other is the discretionary for the counties and the cities, and I believe we have them signed up.
So. Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, let's start with David Brown and Kate Newhall.
Chair Haas, members of the committee, for the record, my name is David Brown. My company is Obsidian Renewables, and we're a larger scale solar developer. We develop projects in what I playfully call the sunny part of the state, and we focus on projects that are 2 megawatts and larger, which is what this bill applies to. For way of reference, a megawatt of solar occupies 7 acres of property, so this would apply to solar projects which are 14 acres or larger. The bill is designed to change current law, which, depending on where you're located, and the explanation from the revenue staff was just excellent, is if you're located in a rural renewable energy zone, which a lot of projects are, because Klamath County and Lake County, for example, have these zones, then you have 5 years of no tax, and then 5 years of surprisingly high tax, and then as the property depreciates, then over the tail years, the tax is relatively more modest. And as a developer trying to finance these projects, it's very hard to get a bank loan that when your expenses swing pretty widely. So the bank loan is based on your lowest production, your lowest revenue year, which is the year the taxes kick in. And what we're trying to do is levelize the tax over the whole period of time. I worked with a number of constituents on this bill, including the counties, and got their support because they don't really like the 0 years. And I don't really like them either. I'd rather pay the same amount level over the period of time. The $7,000 a megawatt is a proxy number. That's what we calculated is approximately what a natural gas plant would pay for property taxes over this period of time. Also, Sherman County had done a study when they were negotiating SIP agreements with the wind projects, and $7,000 a megawatt was what came out of that study, and that seemed to be an approximately fair number. By my calculation, the overall reduction in taxes over the term of the agreement would be about 30%. Other calculations using the red zone assumption bring that number down, and maybe the total reduction is not very much at all because of the 5 years of zero. But in any event, it is not an attempt to go to no tax. By way of reference, many states, California, for example, don't tax solar projects, don't apply property taxes at all to solar projects. And Oregon exempts about 95% of all solar projects because all net metered projects are exempt, and almost all projects in the state are net metered. But again, we didn't think that full exemption was the right way to go. We wanted a strong consensus bill, and that's what I believe that we've delivered to you today.
Okay, Kate.
Thank you, Chair Haas, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kate Newhall, and I'm here today testifying in support on behalf of the Oregon State Association of Electrical Workers. The state association is made up of the 7 IBEW locals in Oregon, and collectively we employ over 9,000 union electricians who perform electrical installations, maintenance, and service. We're here today in support of this bill because, as he said, we believe it will create certainty around the tax liability, which is essential for securing financing for these large-scale solar development projects. We do support clean energy technologies like solar developments, and we believe 3492 is good public policy that will facilitate the construction of these projects in the sunny side of the state. Thank you.
Short and sweet. Questions? You left us stumped. Thank you. Why don't I call up the local governments, Mary Stern?
Chair Haas?
Yes, sir.
If I can answer Senator Boquist's question, because he reserved it for the panel, Representative Smith Warner on the record explained that she was a no because she wanted the League of Cities Amendment included. Representative Whitsitt did not explain on the record her reason for a no vote.
Thanks. Mary Stern and Wendy Johnson, please.
Good morning, Chair Haas, members of the committee. My name is Mary Stern, and I'm here on behalf of the Association of Oregon Counties and the Community Renewable Energy Association, or CREA, in support of House Bill 3492A4. The proposal before you today has been carefully crafted with the involvement of AOC, the assessors, and LOC, and we're hoping that this will provide easy administration and some consistency. Currently, developments would are under the bill. They would not be centrally assessed, which they are now, but they would instead be locally assessed. Both AOC and CREA have been highly supportive of community-scale renewable energy projects because they are of a size that can be owned, established, and operated locally, providing a higher level of economic impact to the communities in which they operate. And solar energy projects related to this proposal are, by their very nature, community scale of 10 megawatts or less. And it's anticipated that this bill may lead to 6 to 8 new projects with 6 to 7 megawatts per project within the state. And you heard each megawatt needs about 7 acres, and at $7,000 per megawatt, the payment in lieu of taxes would be about $1,000 per acre. The counties most likely to see development are Malheur, Harney, Jefferson, Wasco, Morrow, Umatilla, Lake, and Klamath, where low-value farmland is specially assessed at a rate of approximately $2 per acre. So passage of this bill has the potential to increase county revenues somewhere between $252,000 and $392,000 per year. And in places like Harney County, where their general fund, their property tax revenues and payment in lieu of taxes revenues are about $3.4 million per year, this is a significant sum. This proposal is a good step towards creating more solar renewable energy in Oregon and a great opportunity for economic development in rural states, rural areas of the state. And I would say in Lake County, I was speaking with Commissioner Dan Schoen down there. They have several projects already in operation down there, and they're assessed all over the board. There's no consistency. They're working on developing some new projects, and they would like to know what their revenues will be, and they would like the consistency to be provided to the developers as well to assist with them in getting financing. So with that, I'll stop there and take any questions you might have after Wendy.
Chair Hass, members of the committee, my name is Wendy Johnson here on behalf of the League of Oregon Cities. The League is in support of the bill with the -4 amendments. As staff explained, those amendments make two changes. One, to make it clear that it's a permissive agreement. The underlying bill uses the language shall enter into an agreement. And so an agreement by its nature sounds like it's a permissive thing, but it says shall. So it was just a little unclear to us. So we wanted it made very clear that it's a permissive thing. The project would be located in a county, the county would have to agree. If it does happen to be located in city limits, which we understand that's likely not to be the case, but if it is, you know, part of that 7 acres or more would happen to be in city limits, then you would have to have an agreement with the city as well. And again, it would be permissive. So that's the first part of the amendment. And the second part of the amendment on line 17 to 20, make it clear that if there's a penalty, if the project owner doesn't pay their property taxes in lieu of payment, that penalty would be distributed the same way that the taxes, the payment would have been under the tax stream. So that way, if a school district is, you know, there's a school district in that project area, they would get part of the payment as well. Otherwise, it would, the way the original bill was written, it would only go to the county instead of fairly distributed. So, and if it was located in cities, they would get a portion. So that's the reason for why we wanted those two changes. The bigger reason is that a payment in lieu of is a very different tax tool. And it's not as secure as property taxes. You can't put a lien on it the same way. So it's the penalty is important to make sure that we get that, have that hammer, essentially, if it's not paid. It's not the same as your property taxes when you don't pay that. So we need to make sure there is a penalty available, and that was put into the bill to get consensus. Because of the previous bill, I just wanted to put on the record that this payment in lieu of taxes is a relatively new tool in Oregon. We don't use it very often, but it is one that works well in complicated areas where you have mixed use. And so this may be something we can use for the charitable exemption, for example, when you're trying to figure out how to what's charitable, what's not. Some states are using payment in lieu of. And so this is a good pilot type project, and pilot is the acronym for payment in lieu of taxes, coincidentally enough. But I just point that out. We appreciate the work of the proponents to make these two changes. To answer Senator Boko's question, we agree with the proponents that the two no vote, or at least one of the no votes, the reason was we wanted those two clarifications that it's permissive and how the penalty would be distributed. Those were concerns we had. We just ran out of time in the House to get it all tightened up on amendments. There is also a sunset on the bill, and it's permissive, so that makes us more comfortable in trying to figure out, is this 7,000 or the megawatt number, is that right? It allows us to come back if it's not working right with comparing to other energy sources. Makes us have to come back in that amount of time, but because it's permissive, if it's not working out, we can also come back and adjust that number if need be, so that makes us comfortable with the bill.
Questions? Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And actually, kind of more of a statement and a request for the organization of the cities and the counties, because solar, like wind, is generally a more inclined to be a rural project. And I think, unfortunately, as we've stepped through this in the last decade, and I may not even survive the political consequences of this session, so it might not matter, but I think all legislators in the future share a concern that we had in the past, that I would ask the cities and counties to reach out to their organizational members and make sure that we do this logically. And that is that in the race to get projects like solar and wind and so on and so forth, unfortunately, some of those contractual agreements at the governmental level have not been adequate. And so in many cases, because these are driven as contracts and in lieu of payments, as the cities has pointed out, and what has ended up with is part of the project being in the county giving away the credits or the money,
and then everybody living, operating in offices in another county who gets the benefit, and it didn't have anything to do with the giveaway on the other side. And I think Washington County and some other counties have done a fairly decent job, which is why we're arguing about gain share and SIP and everything else. And I would just ask the city and county organizations make sure that as part of their educational process that those small counties who might benefit from this do have some good advice of, like, don't the details or the death is in the details. Don't come back to the legislature afterwards and say, oh, we gave away the house, but we didn't get any for it. Now we want you to subsidize us because we did this. And we've had this unfortunate wind projects where the towers went up and all of the maintenance and offices ended up in neighboring counties who got the economic benefit. And I would just caution, as with all things that are permissive, big term is that, you know, that we make sure that our sister counties and sister cities help each other so somebody doesn't think it's a good idea and then end up being a bad idea, and we, the legislature, have to bail them out. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Other questions, Senator Bertrager?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm still uncertain how it would work if the fees weren't paid. So, like, you know, a county, after a certain period of time that taxes aren't paid, forecloses on the property. I'm still not certain if the fees aren't paid, what happens?
Chair Haas, Senator Bertrager, I don't know the exact details, but my guess is that you'd need to get a judgment and you'd have to execute on that judgment. It would be a normal debt issue, and that's why it's not as secure as a property tax lien.
Chair Haas, Senator Bertrager, I believe as well that the once the fine is imposed, then the property will be assessed as it would have been previously. So, you know, without a red zone, just assessed regularly. So then it would, you know, it would only be 1 year's worth of non-payment that would have to be collected.
Well, then you go back to the old system.
Old system, right, where there could be a lien.
Right.
Follow up.
How would this work if a nonprofit company or a group would do this? I mean, they wouldn't have to pay the fee, or would they have to pay the fee?
Chair Haas, Senator Bertrager, I believe Tom Linares is signed up to testify, yeah. And I bet he would have a great answer for you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Let's bring up the neutral third party of the Oregon State Association of County Assessors, represented by Tom Linares.
Be generous, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure they're neutral all the time, but that's okay.
Senator Haas, members of the committee, my name is Tom Linhares, and I represent the Oregon State Association of County Assessors. Again, we don't take issue on policy questions of exemptions, what property should be taxable, what property should be exempt, although this bill is probably on the plus side because it isn't an outright exemption. The proponent's property owner does want to pay some taxes, and that was appealing to us. I just wanted to testify that we've worked closely with the proponents of the bill, and they've been very, very willing to tweak the bill, to change it so that the administration of the program can work as efficiently as possible, because quite honestly, the way the bill was first written, it didn't work very well, but they were very, very helpful, willing to work with us so that assessors could actually administer it, and it turns out to be a fairly simple process. We used to do this all the time back when timber paid severance taxes, and that money was distributed in a similar fashion to the way this is, and there's a current exemption statute in lieu of tax payment for port property, and we sort of modeled this bill after the port property in lieu of tax. So administratively, it should be fairly easy to administer, and the time frames were changed again at our suggestion. The proponents were more than willing to do that, so the time frames work for us. So it actually is a bill that assessors can implement relatively efficiently. So that was my testimony. And I'm sorry, I was reading something. If there was a question, I guess I need to have it repeated.
Senator Bertrager.
How would this work if a nonprofit group or company, would they have to pay the fees? Like, they don't pay property taxes, would they have to pay the fees?
Chair Haas, Senator Bertrager, that's with all due respect, you've sort of fallen into a common misconception. Just because a nonprofit organization owns property doesn't necessarily mean it's exempt from property taxes. Unlike income taxes, there has to be a statute which exempts the property. If the property is being used for charitable purposes and it's owned by a nonprofit, it can be exempt. If a property is being used for scientific purposes and is owned by a nonprofit, it can be exempt. But if a nonprofit owns a piece of bare land, that's not a charitable use, so it would be taxable. So in this case, because a nonprofit owned a solar project and was selling the power, then there's no statute exempting that, so they would qualify for this program. Because otherwise it would be fully taxable. It wouldn't be exempt from property taxes strictly on the basis of it being owned by a nonprofit corporation.
So the scenario would be if a nonprofit group owned the project, but they were using the proceeds for charitable purposes, less their administrative cost, would at that time they be exempt from paying the fees?
Chair Haas, Senator Borchinger, my personal opinion would be no. Other assessors might consider that an exempt use and would exempt the property. It falls back on the poorly written, ill-defined statute 307.130. I don't think there's a clear-cut answer to that question, which is not the way the statute should be written. It should be clearer than that, but it's not. What you're referring to is destination of income, and there's no clear guidelines on whether strictly a destination of income pulls back to the property and allows it to be exempt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Boquist?
Mr. Chair, I nominate Senator Burchiger to head up the work group to solve the nonprofit issue because I don't want to handle this one.
I'm not open for nominations.
Senator Boquist, actually on the House side, there's a bill, House Bill 3034, dealing with hospital and other medical facilities owned by nonprofits. And one of the alternatives we've suggested to that bill, if it doesn't look like that's going to make it through this session, one of our options was to form a work group to completely break down and study ORS 307.130 and come back to the legislature with a statute that actually works, because it doesn't work currently.
Yeah, no kidding.
Yeah.
Other questions for the assessors? Thank you, Tom. And finally, Jody Weiser and Marsha Kelly.
For the record, Jody Weiser with Taxpayers of Oregon. Our primary concern with this bill, most of them were addressed in the Dash Force, but there are still other property tax breaks that could be used along with this, and it doesn't seem like the best use of land. For instance, someone could build a large commercial scale solar facility in a regular enterprise zone and have 5 years of no taxes, and then roll into this program, you've given the counties discretion, so they would have the discretion not to do that. But it seems like it should be written, the law should be written so that there would be no double dipping like that. And as far as we know, no solar facilities have been put in SIP properties, but of course they could be in the future, and that's eliminated. And the rural renewable energy zone can't be used in concert with this. But we've got a couple of exemptions for property while it's being constructed that could be used in addition to this, and the regular enterprise zone could be used in addition to this, and it seems like a well-constructed bill would eliminate the possibility for that kind of double dipping. That's our concern with the bill. Otherwise, obviously we want solar facilities built, and we need to figure out options for how to tax them. Thank you.
Chair Haas and members of the committee, my name is Marsha Kelly, and I'm testifying for the Oregon Women's Rights Coalition. We're a member of the Oregon Revenue Coalition, and we spent some time going to all of the tax credit committee members talking about due diligence before you put in new tax credits. And what one of the issues that I bring up is our third bullet point question. Are there any objective studies or other data to support the claim that there would be a public benefit, social, economic, or otherwise, that would not occur but for this program? If you take a look at the already cited solar projects in Oregon, it does seem that we are getting solar projects. And if you look at the ones that are approved or pending, I have an Excel spreadsheet that I'll share with you after my testimony. It does not look like this incentivizes people to do solar. In doing just a little bit of research and discussing funding, new market tax credits, one of my unfavorite things, but new market tax credits can be used for financing. The proponent of the bill is involved in solar. A project that he has is now at its time limit of having a deferral on property taxes, and so we now have this program that would be a payment in lieu of taxes. There is a state concern, not just a property tax concern for the local governments. In Lakeview, Oregon, Solar Outback is assessed at $21,530,000. In Lake County, if they're at their max for $5 for the school district, that would be $107,650 to Lake County School District. And it seems that they should be probably quite almost at their $5 limit just from looking. I couldn't find that figure exactly, but in just looking at the total tax burden for the cities and then looking at what the county tax burden was, it looks like the school districts would be there. And as you know, the flow between giving up property taxes that include school district property taxes and the state school fund and equalization means that the state does have a concerted interest in when we give away property taxes. This is a new property tax deferral in an industry that is growing and booming right at the moment, according to what I read in just Googling solar, the solar industry. The costs have gone down for building these facilities, and the concern that some people expressed over on the House side was that they were hoping that there would be money to pay this fee for the 20 years out. But any good business is going to continually revitalize something that they're getting money from in, and as solar becomes more used as a source for electricity, I cannot imagine a good business plan where you were not continually renewing your solar panels that are located someplace where they are generating revenue for you. I just want to bring the concern that we have as members of the Oregon Revenue Coalition that the but-for questions and the other questions for the due diligence on tax measures is brought to this bill before it gets to the tax credit committee. That's where it's going to go. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? All right, Senator Boquist, we're in a work session.
I don't think it goes to tax credit, does it?
It does not.
Mr. Chair, I move the A4 amendment into House Bill 3492.
Senator Boquist moves the A4s into House Bill 3492. Any discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, A4s are adopted.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3492 as amended by the A4 to the floor with a due pass.
Senator Boquist moves House Bill 3492 to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Senator Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The base bill I would have been a no on. But with the amendments that have been placed in, I can actually support the bill barely, but I will support it. So I just wanted that on the record.
Thank you. Other discussion? Further discussion? Senator Bertschiger?
Yeah, I will support the bill. However, obviously there's some questions still needs to be answered over the assessment and the relationship to nonprofit companies or groups that could take advantage of this.
Voluntary debt at the work group, hasn't he?
Okay. Further discussion? Any objections to House Bill 3492? Seeing none, House Bill 3492 passes and advances to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a do-pass recommendation. I think it would be appropriate if we had our environmental guy, Senator Edwards, carry this bill on the floor.
Be happy to.
Okay. I'll close the work session and public hearing on 3492. And we will move to open up a work session on Senate Bill 925. Committee, you know there are two bills in this new amendment here that we've been working on as concepts for tax reform. One is the property tax change, and one is a look at the commercial activity tax to replace some other taxes. And after discussing this with Senator Boquist and other members of the tax reform work group, it's becoming increasingly clear that both of these bills represent pretty big bites for this legislative session, given the vibe that exists in the legislature and in our state, and the fact that there's still quite a bit of technical work that would be necessary to get these bills ready for prime time. So in the pattern that was set with Senator Boquist's earlier bill on carbon taxes, in which a study was done by the excellent resources of the legislative revenue, their computer modeling through OTEM, what seems like a more likely scenario is to get these bills in concept studied by LRO, not a task force, but by the professionals, to get them ready for the February session, in which at that point would be a more appropriate time to consider whether to pull the trigger or not. So Dr. Warner is here to walk us through the amendments and give us the wisdom that he often shares with us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So the Senate
Bill 925-2, this is actually a substitute for the dash 1 that you had adopted a couple weeks ago. What it does is, as the chair explained, it lays out really kind of a task for us in legislative revenue, of course, working closely with Department of Revenue in terms of data and also in terms of their insights in administering any proposed changes in restructuring of the tax system. There's specifically the outcome of the bill should be at least two bills that would come before the 2016 session. One would be you started really with the dash one amendment to 925, but this would be more general and would be the basis for an actual bill that you would have as a presumably as a committee bill to introduce in the February session. You can see under section one, sub A, it lays out the elements as we had discussed in the dash one. It repeals the corporate income tax, reduces personal income tax rates, increases the standard deduction, so a revamping of the state's income tax system. In order to offset those revenue losses, there would be the framework established for a commercial activity tax, which would set in place a tax rate, a threshold, as you would call in the Ohio system. There is a threshold, a filing threshold, and then there's a flat amount up to $1 million, and then a percent applied above that. And then there would be clarification around the tax base that would be part of that bill that would come in 16. The other major element is the property tax, which you had looked at in terms of an SJR, SJR 27, had hearings on that. And again, this is a very bare description here, but would have the two key elements that you've discussed. The first would be to return to a market value-based property assessment system. And we would interpret that to be pretty general. I mean, we talked about the idea of perhaps of not using just a single year, but perhaps a moving average of market values. But it would replace the Measure 50 system that we have for valuation with one that's much more closely connected to the market values. And then the second element of this would be the establishment of a homestead exemption for owner-occupied residential property, and that would be obviously something that would be a reduction in revenue, and Kyle had showed you some of those scenarios about the potential revenue effect. So that would be the second piece. That would have, of course, to be a constitutional provision, and actually the bill you were looking at, the measure you were looking at, was a constitutional revision, so required a two-thirds. So we'll work with that and see if we can develop that more in terms of an amendment. And then any other measures that may fit with that overall restructuring. And then we have some details around analysis. We kind of tried to pattern this after a bill from last session, as you recall, Senate Bill 306, which became the basis for the carbon tax study, and just thinking in terms of the kinds of analysis that would be helpful in terms of assessing these bills. The long-term economic impacts, we would run that through our computable general equilibrium model to show you what those effects would be. The state and local revenue impacts, both in terms of the static effects and what might be the secondary effects from changes in economic activity. We look at the distribution of the state and local tax burden, households and business, but also after incidence of the tax, after wages and prices have affected the economy, look at how that will impact the distribution of the tax burden across income groups. And then the other issue you've talked a lot about, which would be outside of the CGE model, would be an analysis of the impacts on stability of the state and local revenue system. And that we do have some mechanisms to do that would give you some insights in how that might affect the revenue stream over the course of the business cycle. Then any administration issues, and we'd rely on Department of Revenue to help us there to try to point out their thoughts on what administrative issues may arise with the kinds of changes we're looking at. We do have built in a report December 1, 15 to the Interim Revenue Committee prior to December 1. I think we have Interim Committee meetings in November for the Senate and House Revenue Committees, and so we would update the committees at that point, and then we would have, by the time the session begins in February, which will come all too quickly, we will have some bills that will reflect these proposed changes.
Thank you, Paul.
We do have a fiscal impact on this. From our standpoint, we would, of course, if you approve this, this will become our top priority, but it will also be something that fits clearly within the purview of what we would do, and so we've given it a minimal fiscal impact.
And I noticed there are no rates in here, which I think is appropriate given the rates in after the study.
And Mr. Chair, what I was thinking in terms was looking at some scenarios where we would look at some different rates, what the revenue impacts would be under those different rates, and compare that with different changes in income tax rates associated with different rates for the CAT. So you'd be able to look at those scenarios and see how that might play out. So give you kind of a range.
All right. Obviously, we would need a statewide vote on the property tax measure. And the conventional wisdom here is that there's more than one subject, even though the subject is property taxes. And therefore, that's why we need what's known as a revision. Could you go through the...
Yes, the revision issue is in the building issue, where the votes you would need to get it out of the legislature. If it's a revision, it means it affects multiple subjects. So, in the case of the SGR 27, that was deemed to be a revision because it did restructure the property tax system and created this new exemption, which was the homestead exemption. So that was the thinking behind that being revision. Revisions require a two-thirds vote in each chamber. But then once it got out, then it would be it would go to the ballot as a normal majority vote.
Senator Riley? Senator Boquist?
Are we in a work session?
We might.
I'll talk about the drink once we're in a work session.
Well, I think this is a pretty logical step. I'm very serious about moving these through. We've had a brief poll done on the property tax measure this last month, and it was very encouraging. People respond to tax cuts. So I'll take a motion, Senator Boakley.
Mr. Chair, I move that we reconsider the vote for which the dash one was adopted into the original SB 925.
Senator Boakley moves that we reconsider the vote by which the dash one was adopted on Senate Bill 925. Discussion? Objections? Seeing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash two amendment dated 6/1/15 into SB 925, and then I'll talk to my amendment.
Senator Boakley moves the dash one amendments into Senate Bill 925. Discussion, Senator Boakley. Senator Boakley moves the dash two amendments to Senate Bill 925. Discussion, Senator Boakley.
Well, Mr. Chair, I mean, we're in our third or fourth session of trying to figure out how not to go off the Grand Canyon in our tax system. There's your Swiss Alps, which I guess actually looks like the Greenhorns or something around the Wallowa Mountains or out there, the Elkhorns or something. And then we finally came to the conclusion a few years ago, kind of like the federal government sequestration on tax credits, where we had to sunset them all to kind of make us continue to look at this thing as we go forward. And this is a, for a better word, an insurance policy to make sure we continue to have this discussion and figure out a tax structure for the state that is fair, equitable, and sustainable, which has kind of been the goal beforehand. And so I see this as kind of a warming up, because just like saving for a rainy day, all 90 legislators always agree to that. It's just when you come to the vote, it gets a little bit dicey of how do we do this? And so I think this is a good mechanism for us as a body and for the committee to take and get our comrades in the Senate and the House to agree that this is a top priority and we need to continue to move forward. And it also alerts the stakeholders that are sitting in the room out here and elsewhere to say, you know, we're going to go through this process. You need to step up and participate and help us solve the solutions that the state needs in the future. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Further comments?
Mr. Chair, just if I could clarify for the record, the dash twos will then be substituted for the dash ones.
Right.
In terms of the motion.
Okay. Okay, seeing no further discussion, we have moved the dash twos and adopted them.
No.
We will adopted then,
is there opposition?
Without objection, we will
Mr. Chair,
substitute
I,
the dash twos.
Mr. Chair, I move SB 925 as amended by the dash two to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Boakley moves Senate Bill 925 as amended by the dash twos to the floor of the Oregon Senate with do pass recommendation. Discussion?
Yeah.
Senator Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to wait until we were moving this to make this comment, but I agree with the Senator Boakley that, you know, this is something that we need to look at seriously. I don't believe that if we were creating a tax system from scratch that we would have the one that we currently have.
And
so I think that we need to look at it in detail and see if we can't come up with the taxation system that, as Senator Boakley said, is fair and equitable. And I think that this is a good step. Thank you very much.
So. Thank you, Senator Bertschinger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, obviously, this is an extremely long road that you've put us on, and that I hope that Dr. Warner and his cohorts can give us a very accurate map to travel on. Thank you.
Further discussion? I am very encouraged by the initial economic benefits of both of these that our computer sampling for the work group showed in both the property tax measure, which will have some enormous housing benefits and construction jobs and all of those, as well as the decrease in the income taxes having a benefit to our economy and job creation as a result of moving to a commercial activity tax. And I'm certain we'll see more of that as the studies get a little more focused and in depth, and it is a long road. It's a marathon, not a sprint.
That's right.
This is what we need to do, and these were the three bills that came to the top in our work group. One of them we've passed, the capital gains savings bill, and you know, this These are ideas. These are concepts. They may not be there, but what I always tell my colleagues, if you don't like these, then show me something better. And if you don't, then what you're choosing instead is to stay with what we have, which isn't working. So with that, if there's no further discussion, is there any objection? Seeing none, measure Senate Bill 925 moves to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a due pass recommendation. Senator Boquist and I will be the carriers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 925. So we're just going down the order of the agenda here. And that gets us to sand. We're on slippery, sandy soil here. Quicksand. We're into I'll open up a work session on House Bill 3030. We have no witnesses here, and we're in a work session, Senator Boquist.
Oh, boy. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just delighted. Mr. Chair.
Does anybody need a briefing before we're ready to go? This is
Well, I don't know if I'm ready to go, but
all right. Actually, there is a dash one. Okay. And there is an amendment.
Let's go with Kyle for a briefing.
Yes, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3030, as the committee remembers and was alluded to earlier, this is the sand control district creation bill. The bill, as it came out of the House to the committee, there was a limit to be imposed on the total amount of the sand control districts that would be created. That was left blank. The dash one amendment would essentially remove the section four of the measure, which places the to be determined limit upon the taxing authority of the sand control district. So it removes the section that has the blank on what the limit would be. So the limit then on the sand control districts, if they are created, would be set at the time of their creation. So when the vote is when it goes out to a vote and the district is created, it would have the limit of what that would be. And that does fit in with up in OLS there is under the meeting materials a document that lists all the different special districts and their taxing authority based upon the statute reference. And if you take a look at that, you'll see that in some cases or in many cases, there is a limit placed upon special districts, but certainly not for all of them. So it does keep in some cases, there is no limit and it is set by the voters at the time of the creation of the district. And that's essentially the dash one would remove the overall or a need for an overall limit and just leave it up to the voters at the time of creation. The paperwork, we do have the paperwork in, there's no fiscal impact and the revenue impact. There's no direct revenue impact, of course. If a sand control district is created and they're levying tax, at that time there would be a tax, but there is none from passing this bill. It just allows for the creation of the districts.
Yeah.
Question of staff, yeah. Sure.
Senator Boquist.
Just to make sure and really to put on the record, I mean, I think several entities obviously came forward and testified on this, and I was thinking it was Lincoln County Board of Commissioners. Is, I mean, what we're creating, despite creating a taxation district, we're trying to create a self-help mechanism for these people whose properties are eroding away and falling into the ocean and other sorts of things like this. And then what you're saying is then the actual voters who would create that district would then determine the limits in that process in which they create, and that's a vote of the people that would be impacted in the district, correct?
That's correct, Senator Boquist. So it'd be dependent on how it was set at the time of the creation, right. They would set that limit. And a district can always impose less than the limit as well.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I move the dash one dated 4/22/15 into House Bill 3030.
Senator Boquist moves the dash ones into House Bill 3030. Discussion? Seeing none. Objection? Seeing none.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3030 as amended by the dash ones to the floor with a due pass, and then I'll speak to my motion.
Senator Boquist moves House Bill 3030 as amended to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a due pass recommendation. Senator Boquist.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to support the bill. I actually don't like it. I don't like the creation of the tax district, but then I also don't want the poor individuals to have their house fall into the ocean because I've seen this happen before. And so this is like one of those bills that I will support that I don't like, but it is a self-help bill. So I'm certain there are several members that feel the same way, but I do think, unfortunately, or fortunately, it has to get 16 votes to get across the floor and pass. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Burchinger.
I'm not going to support this bill at this time. Doesn't mean that I got to have a few more discussions before I vote to tax sand. after those discussions, I may change my vote on the bill. I don't know.
For the clarification, Mr. Chair, to clarify the record, this legislator does not believe that he is voting to tax sand with this vote. Okay, just to clarify that. I don't believe that that's what I'm voting right now.
Okay. Duly noted.
I'm in the same boat as Senator Edwards, just for the record. Okay. I'm voting for other people to do that.
Clerk will call the roll on HB 3030 as amended.
Senator Bertrager?
No.
Senator Edwards?
Yes.
Senator Riley?
Yes.
Senator Boquist?
Yep.
Senator Hass?
Hass votes aye. The measure passes. House Bill 3030 will move to the floor of the Oregon State Senate. Senator Roblin will be the carrier. And I'll close the work session on House Bill 3030. And finally, we will open up a work session on Senate Bill 415.
Winchester is a place.
That's right.
We have some comments to put on the record here today on this bill. So let me start with Senator Bertrager.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, as we work through this bill, we keep adding some language and definitions, and I think this bill is all about definitions. It's a work in progress, but I still think the definitions definitely need a little more help. So my personal opinion right now on this bill is it's not quite ready to move.
Okay. Anyone else? Senator Boquist?
You want me to walk through the amendments, Mr. Chair, or you want to wait till later? I'm at your pleasure.
We can wait.
Okay, we'll wait.
All right, then I will close the work session on Senate Bill 415. And we will try to take up Senate Bill 663 tomorrow, so we'll carry it over. There will be no committee on tax credits tomorrow, so we'll meet here tomorrow at the regular time.
Okay.
Okay, Paul, anything else? Okay, we will adjourn.